listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 154 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, your host for the show, and on this episode, you're going to hear from Simon Tam, whose band The Slants has been in an unbelievable band name trademark battle that just might change the Constitution of the United States. Before we dive into the interview, though, you need to know that there are just about 30 tickets left for the DIY Musician Conference in Chicago next month. October 23rd through 25th, to be exact. You've been hearing us talk about the conference for a while, and if you want to go but just haven't bought the ticket, hit pause on this podcast right now. Go to DIYMusicianCon.com, that's DIYMusicianCon.com, and get your ticket. If you wait till the end of the podcast to try to purchase your ticket, there might not be any left. If you enjoy the topics we cover on the podcast, then I know you'll love the conference. It's going to have a very similar feel and topics. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be exciting to be there. I'm looking forward to a lot of the panel discussions and keynotes, so you should come. But if you want to go, you better get a ticket fast because we're almost sold out. We also have some great sponsors that have stepped up to make the conference happen. And the cool thing is they all fit perfectly into this episode of the podcast. In my interview with Simon, he talks about how the majority of their gigs come from conventions and alternative type events. That's exactly what our sponsor Gig Salad is all about. There are so many people looking for live performers for their events, and Gig Salad will connect you with those opportunities. In this episode of the podcast, Simon also makes it pretty clear that it's important for artists to educate themselves about how the business works. Our sponsor, Berklee Online, can help you get that education. They're very respected in the industry, so you know the information you're getting is good info. And finally, our sponsor, Rumblefish, who powers the Sync licensing program at CD Baby, gets a little shout out in the episode. So it's all coming together perfectly. And we love what those brands are doing to help independent artists. And we're very happy to have them sponsoring our conference. The last thing I want to mention is that if you want to weigh in on this episode of the podcast or just have a comment or feedback, I would love for you to do so. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. Or call our listener line at 360-524-2209. And you can weigh in on the comments sections of each episode at the podcast website. Well, let's get to my interview with Simon Tam from The Slants. Joining me on the line is Simon Tam from the band The Slants. Simon, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
I often talk on the podcast about how it's so great when I can get artists at CD Baby to record in person, and you actually live in Portland, and we're still doing this over Skype, so it's kind of entertaining.
Yeah, but I guess at least we have some technology to do this.
That's right. That's right. So, but anyway, it's great having you on the podcast. Your band has been in the news a lot lately, and it's kind of an interesting story that I thought our audience would like to hear. The struggles, legal battles, I guess, that you've been involved in. But let's start from get a little background information about your band, and we're going to be discussing trademarks, so we can talk about what that is and why it's important and all that. So I'll let you take it away.
Sure. Well, regarding my band, it's called The Slants, and we're often known as the world's first and only all Asian American dance rock band. So I started this thing in 2007, and it was something that was very intentional because I wanted something that could celebrate kind of my background and heritage. And also during that time period, you didn't see Asians or Asian Americans in music at all. I mean, it was very, very rare to see. And whenever you did, it was like we were kind of like the token players and random bands. He didn't have any bands. Since then, especially with the rise of YouTube, it's blown up, and we've seen a lot more acts. So that's definitely exciting. And we play kind of like a 80s driven dance rock music. So a lot of people say that we're kind of like the modern rock version of Depeche Mode or The Cure, or New Order, or groups like that. So there are a lot of synthesizers, very, very energetic. Our live show is very bombastic. Like, we built these custom light boxes, so we jump on them and they light up the stage and flash our logo. You know, we do all kinds of fun, crazy stuff. And the other thing that we're also kind of known for is our very, very niche audience and niche marketing. So, like, the very first time we were featured on NPR, it was because we were touring the country playing anime conventions. And to this date, we've played more anime conventions than any other band in the world.
that's interesting. That's a good idea just for a tour stop off the beaten path that you wouldn't normally think of that could be a great tap into an audience.
Oh, it's amazing, because we'll play for like 30 to 50,000 people. And they're really, really supportive of our music. Like our first... The first convention we played was here in the Northwest in Portland, Oregon, and we sold enough that weekend to pay for our first album. So,
wow, like,
it was incredible. And so we have a very loyal army of like anime kids and geeks and people who can kind of like identify with us. And we're kind of geeky ourselves. We play video games, read comics, watch anime and that kind of thing. So it's definitely been a really fun and interesting path. And because we've kind of rolled up in that particular niche and some of the other things we've done, like work with the Asian American community, it's also helped open up the path for us to do other really, I guess you could say, off the beaten path kind of shows. Like, we've played for the Oregon State Penitentiary. We've toured overseas playing for troops, serving on like NATO bases. And of course we do quite a bit of the normal like dive punk rock venues as well. So it's been quite a variety of shows, I guess you could say.
Wow. That I actually just posted a tweet today. I was wanting to hear from bands that have toured overseas to kind of collect a bunch of different stories of artists, of how they got connected overseas, how it went, some highlights, some lowlights. But so how did you, real quick, I'm just curious, how do you get connected into like the, was it USO that you did the shows through?
Well, originally we had different soldiers requesting us to play, and they would write us letters, and I'm like, I don't know how to make that happen. And they recommended we contact USO. Mm-hmm. So that's how I kind of got started. And USO was like, well, you don't really seem like the right act for us, but they just gave me a list of a couple other contacts to try. And so I just started submitting stuff, filling out all this paperwork and kind of letting people know like we existed and that there were active duty members who were interested in having us. The next thing you know, about 4 months later, I get this random call from the Pentagon and this lieutenant, and they're like, hey, the Secretary of Defense wants to know if you'd be willing to go to Europe and play for the troops. And I was like, wait, you guys would pay for us to go to Europe? Of course we would do this.
Yeah. Let me think about that. Yes, we will do it.
Yeah. And so we've been on this like roster of artists that the Department of Defense could call on at any time when they need some entertainment for troops. I mean, since then, we had like things like the sequester, which drastically slashed the budget. So so a lot of acts aren't able to tour using this kind of program anymore. But they're starting to kind of revitalize it again. So it's definitely a very, very unique experience and very cool.
Wow. How many times have you done that?
We just did it the once.
So okay.
It was a two-week tour in Eastern Europe. And then we started setting up other things like off the coast of India and all these private military islands. But due to things like hurricanes and international issues, like a lot of those have been kind of postponed. So
wow.
A lot of that is subject to like if they're able to get us on like one of these military planes or helicopters and ship us with our gear, and also if like there's a budget available for that as well.
Wow, interesting.
So yeah, I mean,
So, I mean, we could probably talk all day about some of those overseas excursions, because I, like I mentioned, I am very interested in hearing how artists are getting tapped into those opportunities, because I see people online all the time like, hey, we're touring Europe or we're touring here. And I've done it myself in the past, and it was very challenging.
But, oh, it is, definitely. I mean, we're actually working on an Asian world tour right now for Taiwan, Thailand, Vietnam, and some of the, like, lesser played markets in Asia, and it's there's a lot of paperwork involved.
Yes,
but I would definitely recommend partnering up with somebody on the ground if you have an existing contact, networking with bands, like kind of like you would if playing shows around the country. If you're going into a new market, like definitely creating those relationships as soon as possible, it's definitely to one's advantage.
Yeah. Well, cool. You know, we're going to talk about Trademark today, and your band has become pretty known for the Trademark fight you've been in, and you were featured on NPR recently, and just, was it like 2 weeks ago, a big decision in one of the court cases was made? Was that, it was pretty recent, correct?
It's been about almost a month now.
Okay. So it's been, yeah.
Well,
okay.
To be clear, there were actually two big things that came down recently. One was the Federal Circuit of Appeals, which is a step below the Supreme Court. They upheld a decision by the Trademark Office. But in a very kind of surprising move, I mean, I guess the odds of this happening are almost like the odds of winning the lottery, the court 1 week later vacated their decision. And what that means in legal terms is, like, they took back their decision and pretend, basically, we're supposed to pretend like it never happened. Mm-hmm. And then they called for what they call an en banc hearing, like the full panel of judges, which is pretty rare to happen. But they want to weigh in on whether our band is going to change the Constitution and how trademark law works permanently or not. So those two things happened back to back just about a month ago.
So I'm sure when you started playing music, you didn't think you would be changing the Constitution. So, in the discussion as far as a major piece of the Constitution being changed, let's talk a little bit about what Trademark is. Kind of go back to the beginning of how this all started, and so people can understand, you know, what Trademark is, why a band might want it, why you guys have run into some opposition, and then we can get into the whole courtroom drama.
Sure.
So what exactly is a trademark?
Well, a trademark is technically anything. It could be almost anything. It could be a logo. It could be a name. It could be like a slogan. Whatever it is, it's actually something that helps consumers identify what the trademark is with a particular good or service. So for a band, it's going to be usually the name of the band and sometimes the logo. And so that's kind of a trademark. And the very purpose of it is for two things. Number one is to help consumers or people in the marketplace to make sure that they can tell the difference between one product and another. So if you go to the store and you buy like a Pepsi, you don't want to open it up and it tastes like a root beer or Fanta or something like that. You want to make sure it's a Pepsi. In the case of music, if you're buying tickets to see a band, like if you're buying tickets to go see the Slants, you want to make sure it's the right band, not some other band that shares the same name. And the second part of it, of a trademark, is to protect the trademark owner's reputation or the investment in that reputation. So if you spent like many years building up your brand, developing merchandise and music and developing like a reputation touring around, you want to make sure that's protected, that someone else doesn't just come in and hijack everything that you've worked for. And so that's kind of why trademark law exists, to protect consumers and to protect people with intellectual properties like a logo or a name.
Yeah, and this is different than copyright, and it's different than like patenting an idea. This is like your service mark that you do business under, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
So in the case of a band, I mean, you mentioned like, you know, hey, so I'm going to buy tickets to see the Slants. I want to know it's the Slants. Do you think it's important that bands trademark their name? I mean, I would assume that most of them aren't. That's why I think that your kind of legal case is interesting, because, you know, probably a lot of bands aren't doing it and would probably just give up after the little opposition that you guys received.
Sure. Well, and to be clear, a trademark is actually earned, not something that's applied for. So bands who tour around and who are really active, they earn a trademark. They basically have one. They just need to, if they want it to be able to receive the highest level of protection by both state and federal law, that's when they actually have to register the trademark. And in order to do that, you have to apply for it. And so there's two levels of trademark protection. One is what they call like likelihood of confusion or common law. So like, if you just go around touring as a band, you already have some protection because you have a history of being in the marketplace. But if you really want to be able to have state protection, or if you end up in like a court case and you want to be able to get attorney's fees back, you have to have a registered trademark to do so. So a lot of bands do have a trademark, whether they know it or not. And that's where you kind of see that little letter TM, trademark. Mm-hmm. The difference between that and the other symbol you see, which is a R in a circle, that means it's a registered trademark. That's something that not as many acts have. Usually, I would say like national acts or people who are quite active across the country will go out and get a registered trademark, because it is pretty important. But it's something that I don't think enough artists do, but they really should, especially even if you're just local or active in your region. A state trademark is pretty inexpensive. You can usually get one for $50 to $75, and it's a couple pages of paperwork. Federal trademarks are usually, you know, closer to $500, and they involve a lot of paperwork, but it's definitely worth it.
So I've been touring in the Northwest, and my band hasn't really left the Northwest. We've got a good reputation up here. People know us. But then I find out there's a band in Florida with the same name. How does that work? Have you encountered that situation at all? If both bands kind of have a claim to the trademark in that case?
Yeah, so what the court system would likely do, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't.
Yeah, I'll put a disclaimer at the beginning. Neither of us are lawyers. Simon has just spent years dealing with trademark issues, and so you probably have an honorary law degree in trademark issues.
at least in this kind. Yeah. So what would probably happen is the court would look and see where the market lies. So if the band in Florida is also active in the Northwest, that's where it creates an issue. And so they will usually go back to history of use, like who's the first to use the thing and how prominent is it. If they're kind of just in their own little nooks, then there probably won't be much of a conflict. But the problem is nowadays, bands go way beyond their area, because, you know, you have YouTube, you have Spotify, you got Pandora, you got services like CD Baby that can take a local band to a national or sometimes international level. So this is why it's really important to get that registered trademark to sort this kind of mess out in court. Because imagine if you did have your band and you found out like one or two other bands have the exact same name, and they were trying to do things like buy a domain name for your band, or you're trying to release a record, and then you search iTunes, and then there's the same band name with a different record. It's going to create quite a mess.
Yeah, and that is, I think, going to become, unfortunately, the commonplace issue for bands that there's so seems like so few names left. And I see, you know, people getting creative, but it's like, you know, the chances of you having the most unique band name and no one else ever having thought of it is so rare these days that typically you'll go, oh, I know what our band will be called, and you go online and you'll find out there's four other bands already named that. So
yeah, I mean, it's happened to some pretty big acts, like you know, Blink-182. They used to be called Blink, but they found a Scottish band with the same name who basically gave them a cease to desist. And Slash from Guns N' Roses, when he started his band, he called it Snake Pit, but there was already another band, a local LA band called Snake Pit. So he had to change his name to Slash's Snake Pit. And so it does happen. And it's why it's important to like do some homework, search and see what's out there before you stick with the name.
So we've talked a lot about you, that you've been, you know, mentioned a lot that you've had some legal issues, but we haven't really set the stage for what the legal problem was that you encountered when you went to trademark your band name. So why don't you set the stage for us with that?
Sure. So I would say it was late 2009. Like we had just done a couple of North American tours and we were getting a lot of national press and quite a bit of spin on radio. And so our attorney said, "Hey, I think you ought to register your trademark. It's fairly inexpensive. It's kind of easy to do, and it's really important, especially as you continue to do what you're doing." So I said, "Sure, let's go ahead." We filled out the paperwork. We gave them evidence. So bands have to submit like proof that they played in a couple different markets. So we got posters from different states and different cities that we had been in. We submitted this thing in. Well, a couple of months later, my attorney calls me and he says, "Hey, we got a problem with your application. They rejected it." So I was like, "Oh, you know," I thought maybe I filled out something wrong or like I didn't submit enough evidence or something like that. And he said, no, it's nothing like that. He said, "They said your name is disparaging to persons of Asian descent." And I remember thinking, I asked him, I said, "Hey, do they know we're of Asian descent?" And he's like, "I don't know. I think so." And I'm like, "That doesn't even make sense because we play for Asian Americans throughout the country. We just did like a couple hundred events for them." I was like, "I didn't even know there was a law against this. What does it actually say?" And he says, "Well, that you can't register a trademark if it's disparaging to a certain community or if it's considered scandalous or immoral." He says that a substantial composite of the group has to find it disparaging, scandalous, or immoral. So I said, "Okay." I was like, "Well, who did they find? Like, where are these like really upset, angry Asians that I didn't know about?" You know. And he says, "Well, they actually didn't find anybody, but they did use a quote from UrbanDictionary.com. They found a picture of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant-eyed gesture. And then they use this website called AsianJokes.com. And I thought, "You got to be kidding me. Like, this is stuff that even a junior high classroom wouldn't accept as, like, evidence. Why is it being used in a federal court of law?" So we decided that they just didn't get it. And so we decided to fight it. Well, that fight turned into, like, over half a decade of legal work. And right now we're sitting at about 5,000 pages for our case alone. And we've done a tremendous amount to fight it. I mean, things like getting an independent national survey to getting an editor at the New American Oxford Dictionary to write like a 70-page report on the history of the term slant, to getting lifelong activists writing in their letters and all kinds of stuff. And at one point, this was about 2 years in, my attorney is like, "Hey, you know, I'm getting burnt out on law." And I think my case was kind of partially to blame. And he says, "I'm going to leave private practice." And at that point, he was actually taking up a position at Rumblefish, the local licensing agency. Yes.
He also used to work at CD Baby.
Yeah, and he used to be general counsel at CD Baby. And so he's like, I gotta just leave and take a break. So we found a different attorney. One that was willing to work pro bono and continue the case. And that attorney was actually saying, "Look, as long as you're arguing we're not offensive, you're probably going to lose because it's a lot harder to prove you're not offensive than you are offensive." And our new attorney basically wanted us to take a new approach, and he called it the ethnic neutral application. So he removed anything in our application that could potentially be interpreted as Asian. So like the pictures on our flyers, font, or anything like that. And we submitted it in. And so when the trademark office received it, they gave us the same examining attorney, the guy who screens the applications, and that guy just basically copied and pasted his response into the new application, which is like, you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to treat every application as fresh.
Yeah.
So he made a big mistake there. And then number two, we got to call him on it because we said, hey, slant is a neutral word. It means a lot of different things. But in this case, you're saying it has, it's absolutely a racial slur. So we said, why are you calling it a racial slur in this case, but you've never done so in the history of the U.S.? This is the only application that's accused of being racist towards Asians. So why did you do it in this one, but not in any of the other ones? And so the attorney wrote back and he said, it's incontestable that the applicant is Asian and is part of an Asian band. So that's where we get the association. In other words, what he was saying is, because we're Asian, people will automatically think of the racial slur and not any other possible definition in the dictionary. Which means that anybody can trademark the slants as long as they're not Asian.
Oh, man.
And what's funny is, like, he goes and he continues, because then when we called him on it, we're like, okay, how many Asian people do we need to fire and replace with white people before it's acceptable? Or what if someone only half? Like, what are your guidelines here on this? And he said, oh, well, anybody that uses the same imagery would also be subject to refusal. And he's like, you guys got like photos of Asians all over your website. And one of your album covers has a dragon on it. So of course people are going to think of the racial slur. But the problem is we're applying for a trademark for live music by a band. The imagery, the photos he's talking about, that's our band. Like, I can't change my face. I'm not going to wear like a mask or something when we're playing. And so that's the irony of it, that in the name of protecting us against racism, he denied us a right based on my race.
That is ironic.
So that's why we've been in court for a long time.
So at this point, you guys are still able to use the band name, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Technically speaking, we can still use the name. It's not like it's illegal for us to use the name. We just don't get any of the benefits of trademark protection.
So where do things stand as it is today with your legal fight?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we got this order from the Federal Circuit to appear in court and to talk about it again. And right now the federal court only wants us to argue about if this law is constitutional or not. The law that basically says people can't register trademarks that could be considered scandalous, immoral, or disparaging. They want to talk about if that's an abridgment of the First Amendment of free speech rights. And because we kind of mentioned in our case, it was like a footnote. Like, most of our argument had to do with the procedural issues and the really racist bias that the trademark attorney used. But we did mention that, hey, this is also an abridgment of artistic and political speech. And so now the court actually doesn't care about any of the other stuff, because the last time they talked about trademark as speech was in the early 1980s. And so that decision, which most people considered a very terrible decision, has been kind of the rule of law for the last three decades. So now they actually want to revisit it, and they're using our case as an excuse to do so. So we're going to just be talking about the First Amendment now.
Wow. So where is that court located that you have to go to?
It's in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow. Wow. So when you get to this level, I assume you have some top-notch legal counsel going to argue on your behalf at that court.
Well, yeah, I mean, so my attorney and his firm is, they've got a great reputation. They're very well established, but we're also getting a lot of other people who are interested in our case. They're starting to get involved as well. So I can't really go into the details of who all is going to weigh in on the issue, but there's some pretty big organizations who are going to be doing so.
Yeah, that seems kind of exciting to kind of be in that kind of place of being a case that could make a landmark decision to reverse a bad previous decision.
Definitely, and it's weird because, well, kind of like you mentioned earlier, that nobody starts a band thinking that they're going to potentially change the Constitution or do all this stuff. Well, nobody joins a band thinking that they're going to end up touring like law schools either. So
that's true.
But now I'm like, they're having me appear at law conferences and speaking about the case. I've done a couple of TED Talks on it. And I've speak at places like Harvard Law and Stanford University talking about our case. So it's a really fascinating, odd thing. And a lot of these like lawyers are like wanting the band to play too. So it's kind of weird.
That's interesting. So what's the feedback been like from, you know, when you're out there talking to people about your case? I would assume that a lot of people are understanding of where you're coming from and support the pursuit of, you know, getting the trademark.
Oh yeah. I mean, people are overwhelmingly supportive of our case because they number one, they realize that it shouldn't be up to the government to decide what's appropriate for my community. You know, like that should be up to our own community. Mm-hmm. And the other part, especially when I talk kind of more in depth about the law, people realize how ridiculous it is. I mean, because they're like, they always think like, oh, what about the Redskins? Or what about this? And what about this band? And it's like, yeah, I mean, they're just really all over the map. The law is very subjective because it's like, what does scandalous mean? What does offensive mean? Like offensive to who? Like yeah. Who gets to decide that? And so that's why you have cases like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. They got their registered trademark, no problem. But when this nonprofit group wanted to make t-shirts that said clearly queer, the trademark office said, no, queer is a disparaging term. I mean, it's the same word. It's one's a TV show, t-shirt. What's the difference? And so on and on down the line, they've done things like that. And so I think it's an important discussion to have. It's one that's definitely important for our country to be talking about. It's weird that it's circling around like my band, but you know, we'll take it, I guess.
Well, what has been the impact on your music career because of this? I know you said you speak a lot, you've done TED Talks, and I've heard the NPR story. I just happened to be driving in my car and had the radio on, and they were talking about you guys. And so what has the impact been? Have you seen more opportunity, or have people kind of relegated you to this? This is just some weird kind of story thing that's happening and this band has to be a center, or has it actually helped build fans for your music?
I mean, I would say it's helped us. Like it certainly raised the profile of the band. So it's kind of weird because now back in the day, like when we first started and we were touring, we were known as the band that toured anime conventions. And we were known as like the only Asian American like synth pop band out there. And nowadays when people hear about us or they talk to me, they're like, oh, you're the band that's fighting that court case. And it's like, now we're known for our legal trouble, not necessarily our music. thankfully some people have checked us out because of the story and also like the music too, so they end up becoming fans.
Yeah.
So I never would have thought that trademark attorneys would be like a big demographic for us, but apparently now they are.
You're huge in the trademark attorney market.
Yes. In fact,
in those crowds, people go crazy for you.
Yeah. So there was a trademark attorney conference in San Diego just a couple weeks ago, and they were talking about us and tweeting about us, and they said, the Slants are the biggest band in the world right now at this convention.
I think it's great for a number of things that you've said, like even referencing the anime conventions to like the trademark attorney conference. There's so many pockets of groups of people that are gathering around a common interest or work, and that sometimes tapping into those groups can be, you know, you could be the biggest band to those folks, and they feel that that's who you are. And it's just, I think it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, why not? It's definitely cool. I mean, however people come to find us, as long as they do find us, and whether it's because they're supporting our art or they're supporting like the causes that we care about, I think either way, it's important, and it's always great to have more friends, even if they're all attorneys or law students.
It's probably good to know a few attorneys, have them on your side.
Yeah, so, I mean, I probably talked to like 50 or 60 just in the last month.
Wow.
So it's, yeah, I'm like the only guy I know that's had like an attorney on speed dial for the last like 6 years.
and at least it's not for having some sort of random celebrity craziness issues that that plague a lot of folks down in Hollywood. You've got it for the good reasons.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
So for an artist that's interested in learning more about trademarking their name, where would you say they should go? Where should they go to find out more information?
I honestly would suggest talking to someone who specializes in entertainment law if you want to get a federal trademark, because the application is pretty confusing. There's a lot of different ways you can get hung up on it, and if you hire like an entertainment attorney to do it, you'll ensure that it gets done right. And for most people, like who aren't the Slants, they'll end up only paying about $500 for it. You know, I ended up paying a lot more because of how many courts I've been to. But,
yeah.
If you're only like interested in getting a state trademark, which is still better than nothing, you can usually go to a site like LegalZoom or something and do that yourself, and it's pretty inexpensive. And it's for a state trademark registration, it's usually pretty straightforward, pretty easy to do.
I know we've said that neither of us are lawyers in this conversation, but at what point do you think it's important for an artist to start considering getting a trademark?
I mean, I would say like when you're about to make a release or about to tour, probably about the same time you're looking to get a publicist. Like those are all really good times. The thing is, it's an investment. It's like getting insurance, because it's making sure that you don't have something that you'll regret later on, either a lawsuit that you're going to get slammed with or somebody else hijacking your name. I mean, these are all like things to do, the sooner the better, really, but especially like as you're coming up in a regional or national scene.
Are there any other resources that artists can read up about trademark? Yeah, I'm sure the trademark office probably has some, but are there any other things that you would recommend them checking out?
The trademark office does. Their website, honestly, is pretty terrible. Like, it's really hard to navigate. But if people like search online, there's a number of good sites out there. I think that Bob Baker, who wrote the kind of Music Guerrilla series, he's got some decent resources to begin with. Here in Portland, I recommend a law office called McNamer and Company, and usually you can just pick up the phone and talk to somebody for about 10 or 15 minutes. It doesn't cost money. You can just do an initial consultation and see if you really need an attorney or not. And they'll give you a ballpark figure, like how much it's going to cost for a particular job. But it's a good idea to start getting to know an attorney earlier in the career than later, because you'll want them to look over label contracts or licensing agreements. Having an attorney help draft up like a interband agreement is like extremely important. So there's all these different things that you can really use some legal help on. And if you start developing that relationship with somebody you trust, it can make a pretty big difference.
Any recommendations for finding an attorney?
First of all, you got to make sure that they're in your state so that they can legally practice in that state. You can't just call someone across the country if they haven't gotten the bar exam for your state. So you definitely want to get somebody who's local. Another is to start asking around. Like, make sure if you're an artist, make sure you get somebody who has experience working in entertainment law specifically. There are a lot of nuances to especially things like digital agreements that most attorneys do not understand. So you want somebody who has a good track record with it and who understands how to negotiate. Law is like super broad. It can cover so many areas. And the reality is that for an artist, those areas can come across from anything from business agreements to licensing agreements to what happens if, like, I don't know, a band member does something really stupid and hurts someone on stage. It's like, where do these things fall into place? So you want to have work with somebody who has some experience or at least connections with the other people who can make sure you're on the right path.
Yeah, I would concur with that statement. That's one thing I didn't really know about law, especially, you know, when my band was signed and dealing with lawyers. I didn't really learn that until much later on in life, where that lawyers just kind of get a generalization thing. When they become lawyers, it's kind of you know law, but you don't specialize in anything in law school, really. It's not till after you start working for a practice where you start learning, like, hey, I'm going to be an entertainment lawyer. I'm going to be this kind of lawyer. And that can send people down in very different paths and focus on very different things. So if your friend is a lawyer, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily giving you the best advice about the music business if they don't know anything about the music business. That's just something to be aware of. A lot of people will be like, oh, my friend's a lawyer. He does, you know, divorce law or something totally different. And that doesn't necessarily mean they know the nuances of what happens in the music business, the tricks people try to play in contracts and do stuff like that, and kind of issues like what Simon's talking about here with the trademark law. It's important to get people that really know what they're talking about. Otherwise, you could even be in a worse off place where you think you've done something right, and it even comes back to hurt you even worse.
Yeah, and the other benefit is that the music industry is actually pretty small. So if you get an established law firm, somebody who works in entertainment law, chances are they have a lot of contacts with booking agents, with record labels, with other people that could benefit your career. So if you're an artist that they really believe in, a lot of times they'll be happy to throw your name in the hat or make recommendations. And so these days you even see a number of lawyers who make the pitch to major labels, sometimes more often than managers, because they already have the relationships built.
Yep. True story. Well, Simon, we always whenever we're talking to other artists, I always like hearing if you have any mistakes, stories to share, or mistakes that you've seen other artists make. It doesn't have to be related to trademark. That always seems to be a popular thing that we, you know, whenever we talk about mistake stories, people really love it because I think we've all done it and we can all sympathize.
Yeah. Man, I made so many mistakes. It's funny. I guess one of the things that I often talk to artists about is that you really need to have an interband agreement in place. It's critical. Because you want to know not only expectations, but what happens to things like shared gear, like a PA system or a tour bus, or who owns the music after somebody quits. Like, these are things that need to be worked out in an agreement, because bands are like roommates or marriages. They can fall apart really quickly. And then when it does, you have people fighting over every little scrap. So having that agreement in place can save a lot of heartache later on. And it can also set up clear expectations over responsibilities too. Like my band members, they always joke about me saying that whenever they screw up, that I'm going to put something on their performance review. I don't actually have performance reviews, so to speak, but that's like, I treat them like employees, and I treat it like a business, because I got to be able to protect myself and ultimately to protect the music.
You know, I'm ashamed to say that I've never been in a band where we've done that, but I can say that in my experiences and with all the bands I've been friends with over the years, I would say that most of the breakups or people leaving, most of them, not necessarily all of them, but most of them stem from the fact that there was those kind of things weren't ever clearly stated. So everyone was on the same page and knew what the expectations were.
Yeah, and if people want a copy of one or something to work off of, I actually put the exact same interband agreement that my band uses, which was vetted over with an attorney. I have it on one of my websites called Last Stop Booking, and so I have like a bunch of free music industry advice. But you can also search for an interband agreement template on there as well.
Excellent. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for the podcast. To close it out, you're still got the court case coming. Did you? I don't think you said any specific dates when there would be more updates or the hearing, or how can we keep up to date with what's going on your trademark fight?
Well, I think we're going to be in this court for probably another year and a half.
Oh wow!
They don't move very quickly, even when they say it's like an emergency. So we'll be sending updates through our publicist and also on our website. That's probably the best way to kind of figure out what's happening, unless someone really wants to follow like a whole bunch of like trademark law bloggers or something like that, because they're like all over this thing.
Wow, interesting. I don't have any trademark bloggers in my blog list, but I might have to add a couple.
You know, it's I follow a bunch of them. It's not the most interesting read.
After hearing you describe your music, I'm trying to picture how the audience reacted at the trademark law convention it seemed like they'd be a pretty stiff audience.
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, they have some pretty cheesy jokes.
Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast, and we'll be following how things progress, and you know, we'll have to have you back when there's an update, and next time we'll do it in person.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks again to Simon for being on the podcast. As of posting this episode, it's just 1 week from the federal court hearing, so there's a good chance you'll be hearing some more news about this very soon. I'll try to connect with Simon after that happens and get an update for everyone. And all the music that's been in this episode is Simon's band, The Slants. So if you're interested in checking out more, I've put links in the show notes, both to his band website and to that band agreement form he mentioned, so you can check those out. And finally, if you want to weigh in on this episode or just have a comment or feedback, I would love to hear from you. You can weigh in by calling our listener line at 360-524-2209. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or leave a comment at the podcast website. And I think that's going to do it. I hope to see you in Chicago next month. And so if you're thinking about going, get that ticket now, DIYMusicianCon.com, and I'll talk to you soon. Catch you later. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.